We're going to start with an anecdote. The man whose house we're talking about used to like to tell a story. Like many of the best stories, it's completely made up, but it tells us a lot about his intentions.
A traveller has come to London. He decides to take a trip out to the southwest. This is Georgian England, so supply your own period detail, sheep in the fields, breeches, wigs and the like. He approaches a local digging in a ditch and asks, "I've heard there's a marvellous old house in these parts, is it nearby?" The man replies in the affirmative. "Belongs to my master," he tells the man, "although I'm sure he will build a much older one next year."
You're listening to a podcast about buildings and cities. I'm Luke Jones.
And I'm George Kinchel.
And this week we're discussing an unusual house outside London. Strawberry Hill is a white Gothic confection built by Horace Walpole out of stone, papier-mâché and gold leaf in the Villa Fringe southwest of 18th century London. He claimed to have built it only to please himself. It was made out of paper, he said, and after his death would blow away and be forgotten. But that's not what happened. It not only survived but multiplied, becoming arguably the foundational work of the Gothic Revival, one of the major architectural movements of the next 150 years. He was an enthusiastic amateur who wrote novels, studied antiques, and held a seat in Parliament. And his house, which has been restored, is a monument to himself and his eccentricities. So who was he, George?
Horace Walpole was the son of Robert, who was the most powerful man in the country, Britain's first Prime Minister. He grew up in magnificent opulence of Grand House, sent off like aristocratic men of his day, although they're not proper aristocrats, not until later on, to Eton, where he started to show a real predilection for arts and writing and sort of romantic tendencies. After Eton, Cambridge. After Cambridge, spent several years on a grand tour, travelling around Europe, spending a lot of time in Italy, hunting out and pilfering where possible, or possibly buying where impossible, Roman ruins, urns, cameos, anything he can lay his grubby little mitts on, carts it all back, arrives back in London, gets set up with some very unonerous but highly lucrative jobs, which also come with a grand Palladian townhouse, puts all his collection up in there, starts life as a public man in Georgian London, but mainly he does very little.
But so he doesn't want to become Prime Minister. He's not trying to ape the achievements of his father.
No, not at all. He's someone who's basically interested in having a good time, in the sort of broad sense of that. He's interested in being a cultural person, but he's essentially not interested in anything that would construe work. Or, well, he's just under this enormous, in the shadow of this enormous colossus. He can never beat his father. He's the third son anyway. He's not even going to inherit. He's just sort of leading life of leisure. Everything's sorted out for him, but there's no real, he's not really trying to go anywhere with it. Except he is trying to go places with it. They're just not politics.
Right. So when he's about 30, he decides he needs a house in the country. And this is where Strawberry Hill comes from.
Yeah, so at this time, rich people would spend a certain amount of time in the winter in London, sort of London season. And then if they were really swish, they would have big Palladian houses up the Thames. And they go all the way from Chiswick, where there's a famous Palladian one, all the way out to sort of Richmond, Twickenham. And people would sort of decamp there around May and hang around until October and look at each other through spyglasses.
And the key thing is that there's a clear form for these types of houses, and Horace Walpole deliberately, determinedly, and in a massive way departs from that form. His house is unlike any other one in this Villa Fringe.
Yeah, it's definitely Palladian. It's like white square boxes with the odd cupola. Everything is symmetrical. Everything is smart. Sort of cubby rooms. Quite austere classical decoration. Maybe some painted walls on the inside if you're feeling a bit louche. But nothing too bonkers. It's not what Horace goes in for.
It's not what he goes for at all. So let's describe what you encounter if you go there today. As you approach Strawberry Hill from the road, you see first a wall and then pressed up behind it, a jumble of Gothic elements. There's a chapel-like volume on the left, one topped with castle-like crenellations on the right, a house and a round tower at either end, and in between there are the walls covered in windows with pointed Gothic arches and elaborate brick chimneys stretching up above the roof of the structure. On the corners of one part are finials, which are the spikes that you're more used to seeing on the flying buttresses of medieval cathedrals than on the corners of a house. But the whole assemblage is gleaming white stucco, which makes it look like nothing so much as a giant wedding cake.
It's way too white. It doesn't look real. It doesn't look like it's in the ground.
No, it's very strange. I think, but it always was white.
We went there, they were raising money because they said the whiteness is going down a bit. And we need to repaint it more white. It was completely.
It was blinding. It was a very rainy day, but it was blindingly white. We can say with quite a deal of certainty what it looked like in Walpole's time, because he commissioned huge numbers of views of it himself.
Yeah, there's no point doing anything unless everybody knows.
Yeah. So we know, we know that it was blindingly white. We know also the ways in which it's changed a little bit, that he always intended it to be, he always shows it partly hidden behind a wall and sort of screened by trees. There's very much a Dance of the Seven Veils going on in terms of the way in which it's shown.
Yeah, to maximise the number of scenic vantage points, you've got to break up the view by sticking lots of obstacles in the way.
I think we should describe the landscape that it sits in, which you can more or less still see. So there is this kind of flat meadow which stretches away, and at one side actually reaches the River Thames at that point.
Yeah, it's very important. This was the last Thames front property that you could get, and he was very happy to have got it. And it's really key. And that's also how they probably would have got up and down, at least the Swish people. The, like, less fancy folk could take the road, but, yeah, you really want to get your boat.
Yeah, so he would come up by boat from London. And the view that he would have seen looking down over his garden would have been full of these other villas like his.
It's a whole sort of terrain that's been completely redirected by one landscape garden abutting another landscape garden of all these Palladian villas.
He described it as a little Gothic castle. That was his phrase. And that places it at the start of something which was bubbling away and would turn into a really major architectural movement.
Although not for quite a long time.
No. It's one of the strange things. One of the things that we'll come to quite often is that he is, I think unwittingly, but at the start of a lot of things. A lot of things which he does turn out to be enormous, but he would never have been aware that that was going to happen.
Which is funny. When we go through them, that these things could be so consequential, because it's all about inconsequence and making everything out of papier-mâché.
And having fun. It's all to please himself.
Yeah.
So the Gothic Revival, which, as we've said, hasn't happened yet, would become one of the big architectural movements of the next 150 years. When he describes it as Gothic, he's harking back to the architectural style of medieval Europe. Gothic is the main style of medieval Europe, although confusingly, it's not a word which anyone would have used when they were still building those kind of buildings.
No, they started talking about that in the sort of late stages of the Renaissance, to talk about it as being bad, basically. Gothic is like calling it... The Goths were a group of people who burnt down Rome. The other groups were the Vandals and the Huns.
Also have bad reputations, both of them.
So if you think of it as, you know, if we called it, like, vandalism architecture, or, like, Hun architecture, it's sort of like that. It's not a positive... We now think of it as this gentle... No, it's meant to be a damning indictment of how dreadful it is.
So it was a byword for the old-fashioned, the savage, and the backward, and... Increasingly, it was also associated with buildings in ruins. Since the Reformation of the 16th century, there were, both in England but also all over Europe, these ruined abandoned monasteries, chapels, other kinds of buildings, which he would have encountered on his grand tour.
Yeah, if you wanted to be hopelessly romantic and draw a link, you could say the two places that did romanticism in a big way are the two countries with the most tumbled down monasteries in them, which is England and North Germany.
And these ruins, one of the things which happens to these ruins in the imagination of the time of Walpole and after, is that they start to become synonymous with a certain kind of like intense emotional response.
So there's a guy called Edmund Burke. He's a big philosopher. I'm sure we'll talk about him at some point. Heavy hitter. And his early big work is about defining the sublime as opposed to the beautiful. And the beautiful is what people like to that point, which is sort of late Rococo. Pleasing, charming, probably got flowers painted on it.
Kind of clouds, lots of cherubs.
Light colours. The sublime is a beauty which fills you with fear. It's craggy mountainsides that you're going to fall off to your death. It's gathering storms. It's abandoned castles and burnt down abbeys and blasted landscapes.
It kind of scours your soul. It's wonderful and frightening at the same time.
I think it's difficult. It seems like a ludicrously like overblown description. But the world was scarier back then. You really could die of all sorts of things. And people died all the time. And untamed landscapes were really scary, because if you got stuck in them, you'd die. You would die. So all that sort of... later on, we're going to be talking about Gothic fiction. And the later Gothic fiction, people were always going out on the heath and getting pneumonia and dying.
Yeah, but it happened.
It is, yeah. It would. Happen. It was scary. It was a scary world. The past is not a nice country.
Walpole's adoption of the Gothic is consciously and deliberately eccentric. He's doing something which no one else in his milieu is doing.
So all the houses around him are, they're mainly the Palladian villas that were built up under the rule of his dad. And his dad's all about, we're going to expand commerce, not engage in expensive wars, make loads of money out of being farmers as well in a big way, like sheep, as well as the sort of the new money of making money out of slaves, Jamaica, sugar, and sort of beginning to colonise India and things like that.
So in agriculture, we mentioned sheep at the start of the programme. So this is a period where the enclosures are really ramping up.
Yeah, they've been going along for a while, but now they're at, this is the real period of, it's the end of the old feudal order. No longer do people and their landlords have some sort of link. It's not about war anymore, it's about money, and it's about making money as best as possible.
So all the peasant farmers are off the land, the sheep are on it, and the profit is going straight to the now commercialised aristocracy.
Yeah, and it's cash on the nail. It's, even if they're in there, it's all about money, and they use that money, instead of fighting wars and being prestigious, to build grand houses and fill them full of art and have swanky parties.
I feel like Walpole is sort of half in and half out of this world.
I think he's on the edge. He's very much in it, really, actually. And he's constantly socialising. A lot of eccentric people withdraw from society or aren't part of it. He's not like that at all. He's embedded in society. He might loathe quite a lot of them, but he's spending a lot of the year in London. He's travelling to Paris. He's in Parliament. Doesn't actually take part in any of his sort of duties. He doesn't debate in Parliament, but he writes lots of angry letters. A bit like sort of members of the monarchy now, I guess. Yeah. Not I could mention anyone in particular, but it's that sort of writing grumpy letters against things he doesn't like.
But the people he chooses to hang out with are cultural people.
Aesthetes. The whole town was ringing with them.
Theatrical people. People who are interested in arts and antiquities.
A couple of painters. All of these people, something important about them, all well off and all amateurs, really. He thinks that it's sort of bad to make your money out of art.
Yes.
You've got to make your money out of either inheriting it, or if that is unavailable, being given it by virtue.
Do you want to... Should we describe any of these views of the exterior, or should we do...
Okay, so this is what you're meant to see as you approach from the road. That guy at the beginning of the story, is he's looking up from the guy at the ditch. This is what he's looking up at.
Walpole produced a whole series of views and engravings and paintings of his house and the way in which it ought to be approached and the way in which it ought to be seen. So here, there's a really key one which you can find on the internet. You see the house is in the distance and it's kind of palely visible above a tumble-down wall. It's parts of it almost the same colour as the sky. The foreground is a broken, ruined wall, which it looks like the wall of some kind of ruined building, which his house is now behind. It's very much a sort of snapshot in time. We see this carriage disappearing around the corner. There is some unknown traveller wearing a broad-brimmed hat who's kind of striding down the margin of the rutted road. And then everywhere, framing everything and crowding in from the edges, are trees. Some of them are like verdant with foliage, some of them are rotted. Like the center at the top of the picture, we can see these little pennants flying from the pointed tower of the circular room at the top of the house.
And I think this talks a lot about one of the big themes of the building, which is it's all about recreating in a jokey way the olden days, the good old days of the whole past.
Yeah.
He called it the ancient and venerable house of the Barons of Strawberry, which I think encapsulates both the what he's trying to do, which is go back to olden times, which he doesn't like modern.
No.
And also that he knows it's a joke.
Yeah. So I think that that's really important, is that he's been, through his father, he's been created by the kind of onrushing early modernity, but he doesn't like it very much himself.
Yeah, he likes aristocracy. He likes the old steady order. He said, the past is safe. You can trust Catherine de' Medici now.
Let's go inside. Did you want to describe how we get in?
So, you go past that tumble-down wall and into this jumbled facade of lots of blocks all in a row, and you go in the middle, and in between two of them, in between a chapel-y one and a castle-y one, you go in, and there's a door, and there's a sort of colonnade on one side. Open up this door in this slightly unprepossessing, funny corner, and you go into a tiny, gloomy room, and on one side, there's a slightly lighter, you're going into a tall staircase. You look through there, the first thing is it's dimly lit from above. The walls are all this funny, browny, grey wallpaper, which is sort of painted with Gothic patterns, but it's very stuck on, and it's like a Georgian, or Jacobean staircase, big square thing, except that it's all done up in cod Gothic. It's got lots of tracery in the patterning, and it's all light coloured. You go in there. Oh, and there are these mad, really dorky stags on the corner posts, which look at you in sort of demented ways. And as you get, they're really weird.
They look you in the eyes as you walk up the stairs.
With a look of profound stupidity. Anyway, you go up and it sort of becomes lighter and greyer and airier, and there's a lantern on top. And you start to pass things like sets of armour, heraldry. And in fact, above the door as you go in, there's his family crest, which he's made up. And there's the family crest of two rather distant ancestors of his, who he likes.
The house is in two parts. There's a part which he really liked to live in, which is the part that we're in at the moment. It's centred around the staircase. And there's a part which is more dedicated towards the display of his collection, which forms a kind of wing that comes off and stretches out across the most of the length of the house. The other thing is that the objects that we're describing aren't there now, but we know they were there because they're all in his pictures, which are pretty compendious. All of the main spaces are shown.
And if you visited it back in the day, which a lot of people did, and it was a big attraction, you would get a guide, and that was basically a compendious list of objects. Some of the rooms have over 100 paintings in them. Most of them not very good.
So the stairs lead up past bedrooms, a breakfast room, And they terminate in one of the big architectural moments of the house, which is the entrance into the library. The library is one of the big architectural set pieces. The bookshelves have this quite amazing...
The reason Luke is struggling for a description of it is because it's a completely pointless object. No one's ever bothered to name them. They're these sort of doors that don't do anything, which are like Gothic arches. It's like a whole load of Gothic tracery, but it's a cupboard door in front of the bookcase.
Every bookcase is an arch, and the books, some of the books are kind of hidden behind the arch, and they go all the way around the room. The ceiling is painted. It's quite high. The ceiling also has, it displays again one of his big fascinations, which is with inventing imaginary ancestors and heraldry for himself.
Some of them are semi-real. He loves the idea of the Crusades, certainly at this period. I mean, his ideas change all the time. But when he's doing this bit, he loves the Crusade and sort of Gothic and knights in armour. So he looks through all the books to see if anyone went on the Crusade in his family, puts their heraldry up, and then makes up his own crusading shield, sticks that up there, and the rest of it's sort of brown and gothic-y.
He has a secret cupboard in there for where he would hide his naughty books, but I think he had quite a limited collection of naughty books.
Yeah, he liked the idea of naughty books. Didn't really have any.
There's a couple of things to understand about the space. One is that because the stairs rise quite slowly around the four sides of this room, you have this sense of being able to look quite easily from one side of it to the other. And so the spaces on the different sides of the staircase kind of look at one another, from the library down to the bedroom. Or
there's lots of capacity. If you're at the top, you're naturally drawn to look down. And there were objects to catch your eye as you went up. There are these big sort of knights in armour trophies. Also, I think we've undersold. It's one of the most accomplished spatial tricks. You come in on one side with a sort of slotted in colonnaded bit, and you go up to the top, and then you go through another set of columns, all made of sort of like totally pointless papier-mâché and softwood, into the library on the, so it's staggered.
Yeah, it's constantly revealing new views, and there's a big sense of architectural event both at the bottom and at the top. The other thing to understand about it is that it displays a lot of his interest in quoting and appropriating motifs from existing buildings.
And the playfulness as well. So on the wallpaper on the walls is a re-go of something I think taken from the tomb of Prince Arthur, no relative of King Arthur. This is the elder son of Henry VII, who died young. Which is in Worcester Cathedral.
And the arches, which are over the bookcases, are all taken from a print of some screen, which I think used to be in old St. Paul's Cathedral, which is the St. Paul's that existed before the Great Fire of London. He probably got most of these things out of books.
He gets prints. He's sort of leafing through. Oh, he's got lots of books at home and big collection. He'd been collecting for a long time before he started building this house. And he's sort of got into the Gothic, and he's going through his books and discussing with his mates what's best. This bit was in theory, in fact, the house in general, in theory, designed not just by him, but by a committee called the Committee of Taste. Seems to me the Committee of Taste is a bit like... He's got this idea that it'd be nice to get all these people round and help him, and it'll be great fun, and he'll tell them everything.
They'll draw up some of his ideas for him as well. I think that's important. So who's on it? There's him. There's a guy called Richard Bentley, who's a draftsman and artist.
He's another aristocrat who toyed around with designing buildings, but he's a little bit more serious. The Walpole at it, you know, he's learnt to draw properly and things.
And there's another guy whose name I can't remember, who is another amateur architect. And there's also like a whole other milieu of poets. One of his big friends was a guy called Thomas Gray,
who used to be on the school curriculum for a poem about a graveyard, and now I guess isn't, and so everybody's forgotten about him. It's another poet.
This is where he'd hang out. He'd sit in the library.
They spent a lot of time in the breakfast room, which is this room, which is also... Most of the house is pretty Gothic in its... But this is not. It's kind of Rococo. It's got this... Is that the one with the wallpaper and
it's
the big
blue and it's kind of blue it's and got white pattern wallpaper.
Chintz wallpaper, and it had a whole set of furniture done in the same pattern as the wallpaper, which is this blue and white flowers, just to make you go completely mad, and had 140 paintings on the wall, and they'd sit around.
Yeah, and talk and
talk and admire purple cushions.
Talk about, yes.
Oh, look at me, I'm so wonderful. Oh, darling, you're wonderful, but not possibly as wonderful as me.
And on special occasions, he'd put on his hat of Cardinal Wolsey or his wooden cravat.
Yes, he had a cravat that's carved out of limewood. It's another anecdote where supposedly some important Germans are coming. I think it's something like that. And he greets them at the front door with his wooden cravat and his cardinal's hat and some frilly clothes. And apparently, according to him, the servants were convinced this was the normal outfit of an English country gentleman.
Yeah, I don't know if that's true. I
mean, presumably they were smoking crack at the time.
The novelty of the wooden cravat is that it looks frilly.
It looks like a real cravat, but it's made of wood. But I would imagine it wouldn't look like a real cravat if you actually saw someone wearing it on account of it being made of wood.
Swinging around like an enormous kind of hippie pendant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, this is also the part of the house where he would write.
Yeah, yeah. Hanging around in the library and writing his books. He wrote books on lots of subjects. I'm sure, going to talk about the novel in a sec. But before we talk about that, he also wrote about, he sort of started off art history and wrote about antiquities and things. All of them in a very enthusiastic, fairly knowledgeable, but deeply amateurish way. He got a lot of things completely wrong. Although he was sort of, they're wrong, but you can kind of see the workings. So it's all sort of, but useless as a historian.
I think that it's that we can't really overstress this element of his character, which is that he is constantly getting really into something, doing it for a bit surprisingly well, given like how new to it he is, and then probably getting a bit bored of it and doing something else afterwards. There's a sort of perpetual cycle of kind of fascination, engagement, and then moving on.
He's got a low boredom threshold. He believes work is wrong. He's a gentleman. Work is polluting. You must never do work. You can't produce anything good if you try. So everything must be done in a state of constant frivolity and silliness. On top of possibly kicking off Gothic Revival architecture, he's got a pretty good claim to kick off the Gothic novel with his starting effort, The Castle of Otranto.
Yes, so in 1764 he sat down to write a novel, and according to some sources, it was finished in 2 weeks.
There are some telltale clues that this may well be true in the text.
Some of the dialogue reads a bit like a first draft. All the action happens around the Castle of Otranto, which is an actually real castle, but to which he'd never been and which he didn't realise was real until after he'd written about it. It's a story of thwarted lovers, a sort of dastardly and lascivious prince, Manfred, his saintly wife, two number chaste maidens, mysterious knights, I think 101, and all the cast are haunted by probably the most novel element of the text, which is an enormous figure in armour who prowls the castle and appears mostly in fragments as a hand or a foot. So this is how it begins. Manfred, Prince of Otranto, had one son and one daughter. The latter, the most beautiful virgin, aged 18, was called Matilda. Conrad, the son, was 3 years younger, a homely youth, sickly and of no promising disposition. Manfred had contracted a marriage for his son with the Marquis of Vicenza's daughter Isabella. The company was assembled in the chapel of the castle, and everything was ready for beginning the divine office when Conrad himself was missing. Manfred, impatient of the least delay, and who had not observed his son retire, dispatched one of his attendants to summon the young prince. The servant, who had not stayed long enough to have crossed the court to Conrad's apartment, came running back breathless, in a frantic manner, his eyes staring and foaming at the mouth. He said nothing, but pointed at the court. The first thing that struck Manfred's eyes was a group of his servants endeavouring to raise something that appeared to him a mountain of sable plumes. He advanced hastily. But what a sight for a father's eyes! He beheld his child dashed to pieces and almost buried under an enormous helmet, 100 times more large than any casque ever made for human being.
Well, there you have it.
One thing that we see here is the feathers are important.
Yes, the sable plumes, they waft, they're menacing, these dark feathers in the breeze.
I think there's a childhood fascination with feathers, which must have occurred at some point.
There's a serious childhood fascination with dressing up.
The next thing that happens is Manfred, ever practical, decides, well, I'll marry Isabella instead.
Well, we've got all the stuff ready for the wedding.
Inconveniently.
What are we going to do?
Inconveniently, he has a wife, Hippolyta, a saintly and devout woman.
As all women are in this book.
He decides he will put her aside. He's going to concoct some kind of excuse that their marriage was illegitimate in some way, and get himself a nice new bride who will produce him a new heir. But quickly, a young peasant boy who bears a strange resemblance to the legendary former Prince of Otranto, Alfonso the Good, appears, enters into a conflict with Manfred, and then all kinds of shenanigans happen. There's a troop of mysterious knights.
Light glints on dark surfaces. Yeah. People look through things at other things they can't really see.
Yeah.
Virginal women run away from danger and are saved by saintly people. All sorts of weird stuff happens with a giant knight. Comedy servants say incredibly stupid things.
An enormous sword turns up at one point.
All the enormous things are enormous to the point where they are the size of buildings.
The helmet, when it arrives, is large enough to be used as a prison for the young peasant boy by Manfred, although luckily he's able to find his way into a secret underground.
There's a great fondness for passageways, caves, delving, sort of secret ways round.
Secrecy and feathers.
Occlusion, looking at things indirectly.
The Great Knight, when it appears, it's always in fragments, so someone will see the hand grasping the stairwell in some way that I can't quite imagine, because it must be bigger than the whole passageway that it's in. The big head reappears mysteriously at some point, sort of waving its feathers underneath a window. There's a big foot which comes down through a doorway and gives all the domestics the heebie-jeebies. And finally, at the end of the book, the enormous knight appears fully and pushes over an enormous wall.
There's a general air of delirious unreality, which is the charming quality of the book, really. It's at its weakest when he has people talking, which they do very robotically for long periods of the book. I think it could be condensed down to sort of 15 pages, and you'd get pretty much...
There's not that much to it. There's a good animation of it, which you can watch, by Jan Svankmajer, which takes the form of a strange faux documentary framing narrative.
We've only seen this in Czech dubbed into Russian, neither of which helped us very much.
It was still quite good, though.
You got the salient points.
Yeah. No, it's worth looking it up. Interestingly, Walpole wrote two different prefaces, one to the first edition and one to the second edition. In the first edition, he pretended that this was a text which had been found in a mysterious library and that he was merely translating.
And there's a lot, this is sort of going back to the antiquarian thing. In the book, there's a lot of bits that are clearly, he's read old books, the sort of trying to get out of marriages by pretending you're related to them in some incredibly tangential way. All aristocrats were related to each other, hence all of the sort of recessive diseases and things.
It's exactly what Henry VIII...
But it's also what people did all the time. It's a kind of... it's the sort of... you'd need an excuse so the Pope could sign all the papers, but he wouldn't generally worry too much. So there's lots of... And other things. I mean, he's ripping off Shakespeare in lots of ways, but in a deeply weird and different way.
So he sets out in the second preface, first of all, he claims authorship of it because he just couldn't bear people not knowing how clever he'd been.
I mean, basically everyone knew it was by him, but there might be somebody who didn't.
But it had been it must have been relatively successful.
Yeah, I think so. He was self-publishing, but it must have got around. It must have got around.
In the second preface, he sets out his intentions as an author. And the critical thing is that he's trying to do a sort of a fusion of two different things. One is these sort of medieval kind of mystery, rather magical romances. And the other ingredient is something more like Shakespearean realism.
I think something even more recent to him than that. Something, you know, Defoe, where you have, you know, he can do a book taken from evidence about the plague in London, but he hasn't done this, has he?
No, it's not.
He says, I want to do a romance, but more realistic.
But it's not very realistic.
No.
No one has... Does anyone in the novel have a convincing inner life?
They don't have inner lives at all, really.
No. Some of them barely have outer lives, to be honest.
Yes. I think Conrad, the guy who's going to be married at the beginning, is quite typical. He's described as waif-like and ineffective, and then killed before he has a chance to literally do or say anything.
Yeah. Do people ever struggle? People more or less just have one quality, which they keep repeating over and over again. Some people change their mind. I think that the most realistic characters are the, like, lechy old men, of which the Manfred is the main one, but Frederick, who's the sort of antagonist, is also a bit... He can be tempted into the promise of marriage with a nice young lady.
But they're not realistic.
But they do...
At all. He's just, let me think of a dastardly plan.
They're not realistic, but they do at least experience some ambivalence from time to time.
I wouldn't talk up that as the strong bit.
No. I guess what's interesting about the book is that it's quite rare to have someone who has a big work of literature and a big work of architecture both to their name. And it's very tempting to try and read across from one to the other. Castle of Otranto doesn't really contain a lot of what you might think of kind of as words with pictures. It doesn't contain a lot of descriptions of architecture, but as we've hinted, it gives you a bit of a sense of the type of stuff that he's fascinated by.
Yes, I think the darkness with a glint of light and the views through are telling. And when he does mention things, it's sort of tracery. Gloopth. Gloopth, by the way, is this made-up word. He made up a word, which is meant to be gloom and warmth.
Yeah, it's a good one.
It was a period. I think Burke talks about a landscape, which is your eyes skipping out over a landscape.
So, what should we talk about? Should we talk about his printing press?
Well, I think the thing we can say about his printing press is he didn't write these books to make money. He wrote them so people would think he was wonderful, and he published them in a building on his lawn, basically.
So he actually produced books his whole life. Most of them were written by him, although not all. And he had something called the Strawberry Hill Press, which did produce, not very regularly, but quite an amount of material over the years. The other key one, which we've already spoken about, is his set of views of Strawberry Hill.
Yeah, so when you went there, there's quite a lot of views, quite a lot of which would be in the guide that you get when you went there, which they make a very small version of now when you go there.
And it shows the key rooms. I mean, they are really interesting because, as we've said, they show the ambience and all of the stuff, which, as is so often the case, got dispersed and sold off by relatives after his death.
Yeah, 6 years after he died, there was a big sale, and everything went.
And it's a shame because most of it was basically worthless and it only really had value because of what it had been, where it had been placed by him and how it fitted into the overall concept for the house. There was some good stuff, but a lot of it was...
Not much. Yeah. You don't have 140 paintings in your bedroom and they all be good.
So they're these black and white, I guess, copper plate etchings, and they're all... They're often in these slightly sort of forced perspectives, but which it's a building which kind of suits that way of representation, doesn't it?
Yeah, some of the rooms are quite difficult to photograph because you'd need such a wide angle. I think that when you... And they're also very... They show a lot of intention. You can see what he's driving at with the images, what he's trying to go for. Sometimes that's what he's captured, and... Sometimes it's not. And also, some of the most interesting things about the house, I think he would have regarded as basically mistakes and aren't drawn at all.
In some ways, this is one of the things which he does which is most contemporary. Like, this, there's a kind of a sort of rich kids of Instagram vibe about some of this, you know.
Oh, yeah, the whole thing's showing off, and it's showing off conspicuous consumption and taste. But
I think more taste than anything else. So what he's really showing is how cultured he is, how unique his house is, and how the house is this kind of reflection of his exceptional
taste. Again, it's all about taste for him.
Do you think, would this have circulated around? Do you think other people would be reading it?
Going to his house was really popular. He was getting, you know, 5 or 6 groups of people a day coming. And when they restored it, they found a whole load of people's calling cards that had sort of fallen behind fireplaces and things. And there's some quite important people. I wish I could remember their names. That would add authority to my statement. But there's sort of, you know, there's European aristocrats, and there's the guy who does the first big excavation of Stonehenge and various bits and bobs.
So, yeah, people would write a letter, they'd turn up, they'd be able to see...
Providing they brought no children. Nothing disgusting like that.
No, he wasn't into children. Walpole was a collector for more or less his whole life, as his father also had been, although in a rather different way. He collected books, antique fragments, stained glass. He had a particular enthusiasm for the clothes of famous people.
Or things he thought were the clothes of famous people. I don't think any of them actually were. No. Not even one.
He had what he thought was Cardinal Wolsey's hat. He collected a lot of portrait miniatures, including some quite by some pretty famous artists. Those are no longer in the house. He had a Roman statue, which one of his friends had boxed up and shipped home from Rome. He had paintings, including many which he'd commissioned himself. The kind of unifying themes and interests are obviously this interest in idealization of history and big interest in historical personalities and kind of inhabiting and understanding historical personalities.
I think for him, yes, the objects are less important as works of art and beauty, as much as you might talk about that, than as keys to get into the past as a place. Another thing I'd like to say before we move on about his collection is it's sort of by force. His father was prime minister and had lots of money and could buy important works of art. He doesn't have the kind of money. He's probably sort of at millionaire level, but not much above it. He had £2,000 or £3,000 a year, which was very well off, but you can't go around buying whatever you want with that kind of money. He can't buy the big stuff, so he's sort of going around and collecting knickknacks and things that are fun and he likes and are small, but he's not a heavy hitter. His father's collection was really important. It's got big, you know, it's got your Rubens and your Rembrandts and Velasquez and all that sort of stuff, and it was part of his father's big house. He built this very grand Palladian house, filled it full of fantastic stuff, had amazing parties, and it's all about showing what you could do if you followed him politically. And it's all financed on borrowed money. And it catches up with him. Like, as soon as he, like, when he's got his political connections, it's fine. He can keep the show on the road. As soon as that all falls apart, he's bankrupt. He dies £50,000 in debt. There's no money left, and it's sold, off en masse to Catherine the Great of Russia. And this is like Britain's collapsing, and Russia is ascendant, was the sort of thing in the, this was, you know, a big, big shame to Britain. And it forms the core of what's now the Hermitage Museum in St. Petersburg.
The collection is all over the house, but there's a particular sequence of spaces which Walpole built to house a lot of the key stuff in the collection and to create these spaces to...
Half the house, or more than half of it, two-thirds, is basically a gallery. It's a museum. There's the bit of the house that he lives in, which probably only really special guests would get to go around, and then there's the tour bit, which you go around on your tour.
And so these are some of the most interesting and kind of adventurous spaces architecturally. He really pushes the boat out in these. And whereas a lot of the rooms in the part of the house that he lived in were adapted from a couple of smaller houses which had previously been on the site, these ones are almost all new built.
More or less all the rooms in the old bit are rectangular, as rooms tend to be. The rooms in the extended bit are all sorts of shapes.
So let's do a little tour. From the staircase, you enter into quite a small room, which is called the Star Chamber, which is lined with green, highly reflective paper.
Oil paper.
Yeah.
It's very peculiar.
I don't have very much to say about it. I don't really understand what the idea is with it. And then through that, you enter into a narrow hall, the walls of which are lined in this very thin sort of Gothic ribbing, kind of diamond pattern, with a yellow skylight which gives light down into it. It's a very weird
sinister colour on the inside because of this yellow light. It's very dark. It's a very odd shape. It's basically an infill shape. It sort of starts wide and gets narrow and then takes a right at the end, which doesn't go anywhere. And there's a door, and then the walls have got this. Yeah,
it feels quite bodily. It's impossible not to think of something slightly biological when you see it. I think this is partly a factor of the lighting,
sci-fi as well.
Yeah, it does,
or horror, kind of creepy.
And the form of the hall is a factor of him having built several rooms first, and then the hall being whatever shape is left over. So it seems quite unconsidered. Through a door... Oh,
but it's also, like, one of the most interesting spaces in the whole building. Yeah. Because it's so weird.
If you turn right out of this little hall, you come into the Holbein room, which is... I don't know if people really slept there or not, but it's one of... It's one of the first like big architectural experiments at the level of the room in the house. It's got an enormous ornate carved fireplace. One of the things that you see a lot of in the house are these translations of things which would normally be stonework in a Gothic building into wood, which is then painted white or grey to look a bit stony. So it's got this big towering fireplace up one wall. The walls are painted purple.
His favourite colour.
Make of that what you will. The ceiling is really interesting, kind of flattened dome/vault. It's kind of curving towards each corner.
Yeah, as you go in, it's sort of sloping down towards the window side of the room, which is circular. And it definitely feels... It's got a bit of that sort of spatial quality of... It's like where you steer a spaceship from. It's got that kind of like sloping... It's sort of Tudor meets sci-fi.
Yeah.
And it's got this funny screen, which is sort of wooden, like, tracery.
Yeah.
That you can see through. It's mainly hollow, which is an extremely elven sort of... It's sort of teardroppy patterns on both sides. It separates one bit of the room from another bit of the room... The bit of the room it separates off is so small to be totally useless.
Yeah, although it's shown with a bed in the plan. Walpole's kind of translation of the Gothic involved a lot of taking originally stone motifs and translating them into either wood or actually papier-mâché. So the ceiling in this room, like many of them, is made of papier-mâché, and the wood is often painted grey or some other kind of stony colour.
It's basically meant to all be just white stuff. It's kind of Peter Eisenman. Yeah. It's sort of like, we just make out of white stuff.
I think he did, you make a good point, which is that I think he did also inadvertently invent the sort of, the architecture of like high fantasy elfishness. These sort of quite light, very leaf-like sort of kind of transparent tracery.
Yeah, nature. But it also, his architecture comes out of books. It's the colour of paper. It's the colour of the ground in an etching. He's literally taking stuff out of fantasy etchings and etchings of real things, and turning them into real built environment, which means it does lend itself to sort of sci-fi or fantasy analogies. And it is weirdly dematerialized. It's paper architecture made of paper,
literally. So that if you were instead to go through the door on the left hand side of the hall, you come rather unexpectedly into the biggest room in the house, which is this massive long gallery,
50 foot,
which
the 50 foot gallery,
the 50 foot gallery. The walls are this red velvet or beige or something,
damask.
I think it's a damask.
The one
wall is got these big windows opening out into the garden. The other is covered in mirror with these niches set into it. There's a lot of gold, and the ceiling is I've forgotten the name for
it. It's like a fan vault. It's a very elaborate, and the gaps between the mirrors on the other side are the sort of piers of this really... He's just turned up the complexity to the absolute maximum.
Yeah, so the
it's all gilded to look like solid gold.
The fan vaulting is again made of papier-mâché. Fan vaulting, if you don't know it, you see it in sort of King's College Chapel in Cambridge, or...
The very elaborate stone Gothic ceilings. But he thought this was probably the most important room in the house. He said he was embarrassed with his own magnificence. And he clearly created this room and then, with the space left over, made the other ones, which is why the corridor going into it is so weird.
So maybe we can talk a little bit about Walpole's approach to architecture, which is kind of to create the rooms that he wants and then worry about how they fit together when they're pretty much already built, or certainly later.
The problems that make it quite interesting, the interesting problems, are ones that are incredibly straightforward to solve if you'd sort of looked at the plan before you built it.
Yeah, you can see that he didn't do plans.
He didn't do the looking at the plans thing.
No. He certainly didn't do working in them, or at least I very much doubt he can have. He's having the ideas. The ideas are strong, but he doesn't know how to integrate them into a building. Yeah, in the view you can see it's sort of got quite a lot of paintings. It's got furniture down both sides, but not that much.
Although it's got this bonkers high level of Gothic development. In a lot of ways, it's the most conventional room. The style of having a sort of long gallery, the purpose of which I think to modernise is a bit oblique, but I think it's where you'd sort of walk up and down in bad weather in Tudor houses. You'd have this long thing so you could sort of walk up and down and chat to each other. It's quite conventional, even though the decoration is really odd. And I think this is part of the sort of consumption side of his. You know, he's making something completely bonkers, but it is fitting into some of the ideas of what a country house should be.
So the doors which come off this space then lead into some of the really eccentric architectural inventions he made, none more so than the tribunal, which is named after a room which he had seen in the Uffizi in Florence, but which is actually nothing like it at all, and really not much like anything. It's kind of octagonal. It has these big leaf-like curving panels which rise up into a point at the centre, so it's a bit like being inside a rosebud or an acorn or something. The roof is incredibly elaborately covered in this very fine golden tracery, behind which the walls are green, I think, aren't they?
Yeah, they were green when we were there. Yeah. It's definitely biological, sort of pumpkin-y or acorn-y or tree-like. Yeah. And there's the sort of funny irregularity to all the tracery was made in a factory and sent down the Thames and stuck on. One of the great advantages of making everything out of papier-mâché is that you can bend it a bit, so it's quite easy to stick onto funny shapes that have been cobbled together.
And the whole space is lit from above by a star-shaped little skylight at what would be the tip of the rosebud, which again is yellow. It lets in this yellow kind of glowing light, which washes over everything. This is where he would have kept the stuff which he was most proud of, the really...
This is where the eagle was.
Yeah.
And the miniature cabinet, which has got all his miniatures in it, which is in the V&A now.
Yeah, latterly when the hordes of visitors... I mean, they weren't hordes, but... Latterly, when he decided that too many
when
people...
When the literally dozens of people would arrive.
When he decided it was all too much, he fitted a gate on the outside of this room and they would have to just look in and feel the objects with their eyes.
Very cross.
There's an assortment of other rooms down here, and it's a bit... you can kind of categorise them by what shape they are. There's a round room. There's a...
Not very good.
No, the round room is quite bad, actually. I'm not sure it's a good idea.
The round room, the thing he said about the round room, the quote for that one, I get this. This is from a lecture, which you can put up a link to.
Yeah, which is... we'll put it up.
I think at Yale or one of the other American universities. Is that he said, in most of the house, the paintings are art, but here they are furniture.
What does that even mean?
I think it means they're even worse than most of the rubbish ones that he had.
So I don't think there's a view of it on this website we're looking on. The there's
it
also
feels like the inside of a very expensive hat box.
Yeah, it's got yeah,
not it's got more of this red silk and gilt, but it's rubbish.
Having built it, I'm not sure he really knew what to do with it. I mean, rather more successful, I think, is the hexagonal room, which is a late addition.
It's right at the end. He adds it on, and it's quite small. It's almost a large closet or wardrobe or something. Mm.
It was and a sort of very cosy parlour. He would go for like an intimate chat with one or two people in there.
You couldn't fit more than one or two people. It's on the edge. It's got its own little tower, and he wrote a naughty book.
Called The Mysterious Mother, which, trigger warning, contains strong themes of incest.
Yes. No, we haven't read the book.
No, we're not reading another book.
And
him.
Neither one, has anybody else.
One was enough. It doesn't even have its own Wikipedia page. There's no...
There's no research done on this. I presume that's because it's terrible.
This part of the house... So we've said that the staircase is by far the most resolved part of the house. But this part of the house is where all the really interesting curiosities are. There are not only these quite experimental spaces which he creates himself, but also all of the leftover spaces in between. So there's this really interesting hall which is created between the vestibule to the tribunal and a room adjacent to it, which is a very big bedchamber, which we haven't said anything about. There's not that much to say.
That he's definitely made, like the Holbein room, he's sort of pretending that this side of the house is a house when it's a museum. So there have to be bedrooms. There have to be reasons for the rooms, even though no one's ever going to sleep in these bedrooms. They're just for fun. They're just an excuse to have rooms. But yeah, there's this weird corridor.
Yeah.
You go along it.
It's not even a straight corridor. It goes, it's like this very, very peculiar, like, double 45-degree bend that you go around. It's the kind of thing that you get in, like, really, really badly converted, like, flats that have been done on the cheap.
Yeah, the walls aren't straight because there's things going on the other side of them. So they've got no relation. And then there's this cupboard in the side, which has got its own roof light. And then there's like a pane of glass above the cupboard, which doesn't go to the outside. It goes to a weird little light well.
It's almost impossible to photograph because it's so cramped. We will put up some of the images that we have. It's really, I mean, it's like nothing you've ever seen. It's full of things which are like nothing you've ever seen.
No one who drew the building before they make it would ever make anything like that.
Yeah.
It's like, you say it's like a badly converted thing. It is, but it's too extreme. It's too weird. And too, also, if you're badly converting something, you don't then make it into like this expensive, you don't go, let's just throw some money at this.
I mean, how do you feel about this overall? I think we've probably got quite mixed feelings about the house overall. I'm really glad to have gone there. It's completely unique and fascinating.
It's a bit like the book as well. It spawned all these great successes. It's amazingly innovative. Lots of functional failures. very worth visiting. It just goes back to that idea of amateurishness. He in the sense of he's doing it for love. It's full of passion, and very little rigor. And it's his life's work. So it's got, but it's got the rooms in it are so unusual. I can't think of in the whole of architectural history things that are like it anywhere else ever. To be cliched, it becomes sort of postmodern. It's all about collage, stealing things. It's all about reveling in fakery, accident, but not liking the accident, and whims. It's just his fancy. It's very difficult to categorise because it's utterly inconsistent. He never does anything for very long. But he sort of just turns his eyes to things, says, it's going to be wonderful, you know, and he really pushes it.
Yeah. No, it's. I think that he also, decoratively, he produces some really interesting effects, which must be at least slightly unintentional, which are about taking motifs which perhaps he's not quite sure of the original size of, and making them a different size. So there are things which would originally have been really little, which end up being really sort of big and massive. Or vice versa, things which are kind of large and massive and grand get shrunk so that they start to have a slightly miniature kind of doll's house feeling to them.
Yeah, and being in some of those rooms, it feels quite like you're in something that's not actually a... This isn't the shape of a room, this is the shape of a object, of a small object, and you have been shrunk down to... It's got this sort of Alice in Wonderland, you know, you're inside a cushion or something. I'm thinking of the room at the end where you sort of feel like you're in some sort of really naff 60s ottoman.
Yeah.
Footstool or something.
It makes me wonder, like, why doesn't contemporary self-indulgence produce such fun results? Like, this is a guy who's a massive narcissist and who is just doing everything that pleases him, but we don't really see...
Yeah, it's way better than sort of mad oligarch palaces. Yeah, no one did anything like him. No. But he was influential, I think, because so many people saw it. And so many people thought, what a funny thing.
Yeah. I mean, there are echoes. So there's this like later and more extreme version of Walpole called William Beckford.
William Beckford's a fanboy. But yeah. He's a fanboy with a lot of cash. Yeah.
Beckford.
Yeah, so Beckford... he didn't just want to be Horace Walpole, he wanted to be one of the mad, bad, and dangerous to know characters in his book, I think.
So this guy, again, is 1830s, I think. Oh, no.
Sorry. Oh, earlier
no,
than that.
No, it's not actually. So Beckford was getting going around the time Walpole died, so sort of 1790s.
Yeah. He inherits masses of money, which all comes from sugar plantations in Jamaica. He's one of the richest people in the country. He's extremely eccentric and wild. He inherits at a young age. Like Horace, he writes himself a gothic novel. It's called Vathek, The Cruel Caliph, or something like that. I don't remember that's exactly what it's called. It's called The Something Caliph.
Yeah.
And it's all about... It's a bit more S&M than...
because of the Otranto is quite prim.
It's quite prim.
No one fucks.
Yeah, yeah. I think people do. People do. Oriental potentates do, yeah. In Vathek. And he sort of thinks he is Vathek. And he knocks down the Palladian pile at Fonthill Bishop. And he builds a massive sort of tumble-down monastery. And he does his own collection of prints. It's huge. It's got this central tower.
Yeah.
How big is it?
The tower is 90 metres, that he built was 90 metres tall, which is very slightly shorter than the tower that has Big Ben in it in the House of Parliament. It's about 6 metres shorter than that. So it's enormous, if you can imagine that, being in the middle of a house. He called his house Fonthill Abbey. He wanted to live in an abbey. When it came to building the tower, he built it the first time and it fell down immediately. He built it the second time. I think it fell down even while they were building it. And then he built it a third time. This is around the point when he starts to lose some of his money.
Yeah. He, because he's a lunatic, a drunk, he basically... Actually, he doesn't really spend it all. I mean, he spends a lot, but it doesn't help that, like, because he's such a lunatic, his business affairs are basically everybody's ripping him all his money off.
Yeah. So he did, after his death, the tower fell down again. I think you've really got to look it up. Well, maybe we'll put a link on the show. But, it's
but he goes full on how he's got his own printing press as well, and he. But there are differences, which is that he doesn't have any guests. Basically, he just likes the idea of it. He goes full on Howard Hughes. He goes full on mad, hermit, sort of, you know,
cackling.
It's quite Citizen Kane, or you know.
What sense do you have of Walpole as like a person? To what extent are we dealing with a massive narcissist here? Like, to what extent is this all a manifestation of this chronic narcissistic urge?
He's a massive narcissist, but he's like, it's a great age of narcissists. He's a very social man. He spends a lot of time traveling around seeing people, albeit he despises a lot of his neighbors. God, why should I have that quote? He's sort of, I look out over the beautiful Thames, but on the other side is Lady So-and-so, and at least I know I'm separated by, you know,
by the river from her.
And he's got a great idea of, although he's very jokey about the past, he does really see himself as belonging to this great long line.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they were sort of Norfolk gentry, I think.
Yeah.
They had lots of sheep. And he's a terrific defender of his father's legacy, which, like a lot of political figures who've been around for 30 years as a dominant figure, was terrible.
When he fell very hard. So, I mean, his reputation is a bit like that of Tony Blair
or Thatcher, who really was very powerful, very influential, and became really despised by a lot of people. Not maybe everybody, but lots of people. All the birds of the air were a-sighing and a-sobbing when they heard of the death of Cor Cock Robin. When they heard of the death of poor Cock Robin. And then it's all about how all the birds killed him. I with the sparrow with my bow and arrow. Anyway, we don't need any more of that. I got sung it as a child. I'm not entirely sure. I think it's probably a folk song that was co-opted to be about him.
One of the sad things about visiting the house now is that it's empty.
Yeah, it's very empty. And it feels very sad because it was meant to be so full of clutter.
Yeah. Without its clutter, you know, in the library they've got, they've like printed out a picture of some books and stuck it on the upper shelves because they don't have enough books to fill all the shelves.
Yeah, and a
lot to go in it. But for all that, definitely worth a visit. Definitely worth a visit. You have to use a little bit of imagination.
Apparently next year, which will be 2017, for all our future fans, they're going to try and get as much stuff as possible. They're going to do an exhibition.
And fill it up.
And fill it up with lots of the stuff, because they have found lots of it. Yeah. They haven't found the mad chintz furniture, which I'm really missing.
No, it's almost certainly been burnt.
I just love this idea. You just have this really loud pattern on the wall.
And you paint
and
it.
And then every single object has also got the same loud pattern in the
room.
It's
crazy, isn't it? It's like, I mean, what is it like? It's it's like a little fever dream.
Yeah, there's a room upstairs where I was never very satisfied with this. I got 9 purple cushions and it still wasn't right.
Yes. If a room fails the 9 purple cushions test, you know it's got to be demolished. There's no coming back. Thanks a lot, George.
Thanks to you, Luke.
All right. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Is there a Walpole appropriate sign-off?
No.
time for another drink.
Yep.
Safe.